fun one today. We haven't done one of these on Dunked On for quite some time, a full mailbag episode. We are getting the questions from our Patreon subscribers, patreon.com/DuncanLarue. And let's get right to it, Danny. What we got here?
We got a nice batch. So these are from Patreon subscribers. So for those of you who are into that, and we said one of the things we said was that new subscribers would definitely get their questions answered. So we might as well start there. So from Will Malloy, new subscriber here, Kevin Durant shot blocking and help defense, among other things, have been outrageous since he joined the Warriors. Can you think of a more impactful help defender that played primarily as a wing in NBA history? And how much of this improvement do you credit to the Warriors' defensive composition?
Well, I'll take the first part. I think the other two candidates that come to mind for me are LeBron James in his heyday with the Miami Heat and Scottie Pippen. Pippen was not, neither of these guys really are quite just the straight up shot blockers that Durant is. But LeBron, I mean, even now you'll see it. When he's in the area, guys are just like kind of scared to go up around him. And I mean, and you'd see that, especially when he used to be the athlete that he was. Guys always felt him around the rim, even if he didn't always jump. And then Pippen wasn't necessarily a shot blocker. He was a good shot blocker for a small forward in his era, but just his help instincts, especially also, you have to remember, and he played in an era where there was a legal defense. And so if you were going to double team, you had to either double team hard or in theory, you'd be called for legal defense. So he had much more ground to cover as a help defender. And he also had to avoid getting called for legal defense when he would kind of help out in the lane, maybe more than was technically allowed for. So those are the two that really come to mind for me. I think Pippen gets a lot of discussion for his on-ball work, and he was certainly quite good there. But I think actually as an off-ball player, he was even better. And then maybe you want to talk about this, KD's improvement when he's gone to the Warriors.
Yeah. So I'll echo your first two. I'll defer to you on Pippen just because I wasn't watching the NBA as closely then as you were. And with LeBron, I thought exactly the same thing. And also both LeBron and Durant have played stretches because they have the size at power forward, which also magnifies their help capabilities because you just get the opportunity to do more of it. And I thought that's part of how LeBron shined in the 2016 finals, was that he didn't have to be on ball as much. The Warriors part of it is significant. I think just having the defenders back there that he trusts, and I mean the Thunder and the Sonics to a degree that first year went through a lot of different guys, but also I just think Durant is taking more of an interest in doing it at the beginning of the season. The capability is there. I mean, we saw that in the 2016 Western Conference playoffs and before that at periodic moments, but he didn't bring it as much in the regular season. That just wasn't a part of his game. He was shouldering a different kind of offensive load. Maybe he just didn't want to. He was also playing more minutes from what I recall. And so I think that has been opened up a little bit. And so you can call that defensive composition, but I think it's more about opportunity, just being able to concentrate a little bit more on it and his own concerted effort to just do more. And he has been better. I mean, to me, game in, game out, he's been meaningfully better both this year and last year than any time as a member of the Thunder.
Yeah, I think that's right. And a lot of it, I think, is being held more accountable in the Warriors culture, being around great intelligent defenders like Iguodala and Draymond, who are two of the guys that are bigger influences on him, on the team.
Yeah.
And then also just...
And communication too.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and better coaching, I mean, it clearly is the case. I mean, he did have Ron Adams in OKC. He's got him again here, but just... Overall, I think the Warriors coaching staff and system is better. But then also something that you hit on is just playing much more four in Golden State and therefore just being closer to the rim. Also, because just generally they switch more, even if he's not playing as a four, he does spend more time closer to the rim, maybe because he's switched. And so he does have more of a chance to get those shot blocks. And I think he's also just really enjoying acting like that. And then the other thing too is just... there aren't as many big guys as there used to be either, and the game is now more about trying to drive to the basket. And so guys who not only, it used to be you had big guys there, and even if you were kind of slow, you could get into position, you could affect guys at the rim. Now speed is just as important in shot blocking as actually being able to get up there once you arrive, because you have to cover so much more ground. You're crashing in from the three-point line, and he's probably among seven-footers, probably the fastest seven-footer that we've ever seen.
I just, as a side note, because I always feel like mailbags are a little looser, I had a funny moment over the weekend because my parents actually went to the game against the Sixers, and I explained to them the whole thing about Kevin Durant being listed at 6'9", but actually being 7 feet, and they were confused and frustrated by it.
Well, tell him that he once said that girls don't like you if you're 7 feet. That's part of why he didn't want to be listed at more than 6'9". But I totally understand it, because it's like, the taller you're listed as, it almost like devalues your accomplishments. Like, you're supposed to be doing it, right? Like, so, yeah. All right. We'll do a more before we do our read. This will be one close to both of our hearts here. We got a couple of questions. Augustus Art Schwager and Doc O'Carter out of Harlem asks, basically, Frank Ntilikina versus Dennis Smith, what do you think of it? After obviously LeBron made those comments that they should have drafted Dennis Smith, not necessarily as a knock on Frank, but more as building up Dennis Smith.
I mean, I also want to note that I think a big part of LeBron making that statement was just to jab at Phil Jackson, who is distinctly his favorite person. But the difference between those two guys is really about ceiling more than anything else. I mean, Dennis Smith has a floor that can be concerning. I mean, we saw some of those negatives for him defensively and some of the red flags in his time at North Carolina State. But what makes him different is just, I think, the burst that he has as an athlete off the dribble. His passing is not elite, like he's not at the rarefied air, but he's probably underrated in terms of his vision. And he has defensive potential. I mean, Ntilikina has obviously done a much better job of actualizing that in his early career, but it's a ceiling play. And one of the questions from Archwalker talked about, you know, the kind of the performance and the projections. And I think for me, when I'm looking at guys at this point, you know, you can of course consult things like what KP does and other things, is that it is more about what I see. And we watched a lot of film of both these guys, and I just see the ceiling with Smith, and that is why we both had him so high and maybe should have had him higher.
Yeah, I mean, certainly Smith, in terms of his physical tools, John Wall, Russell Westbrook, probably the only two guys in the league who can match him at the point guard position. Maybe Derrick Rose at one time could have, but really no longer. Anyone else really who's in that conversation for you is the most athletic point guard in the league? I mean, De'Aaron Fox is close, but not quite there, I don't think.
It's interesting because Lillard is a different kind of athlete. Like, he's a better jumper.
Yeah, he doesn't have the size, but he doesn't have the burst. He's 6 foot.
The size. And I don't think of him as, like, you know, in that conversation of like fastest guy end, he's a very good athlete in that way, but he's not just superlative like Westbrook, like Wall, like Dennis.
Yeah, he deserves to be in the discussion, though. I am glad that you mentioned him. And Frank has shown great quickness defensively, just not an explosive leaper, though, and it doesn't necessarily have a huge knack for finishing. By the way, Dennis Smith already has 14 dunks this year for a point guard. That's completely insane. He's only playing 30 minutes a game too. So looking at a few of the stats with these guys, Smith, 12.8 PER, 29 minutes a game, true shooting percentage 48%, which is not great but not horrendous for a rookie point guard. Usage 30% usage. I mean, just to be able to get up that number of shots as a rookie point guard is pretty impressive, especially in a pretty limited Dallas offense. And he's turning it over a lot, 18% of his possessions. Frank, the big thing statistically that really sticks out for him is 4.8% steal rate, which is extremely high. He's getting a lot of steals. He really is looking like he's going to be one of the best in the NBA defensively at the point guard position for a long time. Offensively, though, he has shown more passing vision than I thought, but really other than that, shooting 34% from the field, 24% from three. The jump shot that he showed, I think, will come around. I think he's going to get to be a solid shooter, but he doesn't have, and the number one skill in the NBA to me, what people really pay the big bucks for, is efficiently creating shots for yourself and others. And I think that Smith can get there. His usage rate is promising. Just the way he blows by guys is promising. He's got to work on his handle, actually. He could really tighten that up. But even as he is, he's able to just, you know, if he gets a big on him, he can just blow by him pretty much any time. And then his three-point shooting, he's been very aggressive from downtown, maybe a little bit too much, but he's up to 32%. He's taking 5 threes a game. He's 22 out of 68, and Frank is only 5 out of 21 so far.
Something I do really like about Ntilikina that could be potentially potentially useful down the line is I think he's been better as a point guard and as a primary ball handler at this point than I expected. Full credit to him for that. His passing has been better. His handle has been a little bit better. But what made him intriguing to me, same way it was for Dante Exum, was that I think he can defend multiple positions. And with Frank, it's even clearer. So that provides a different value. So even if he doesn't get to the point where he can be your lead guy, where he can be, you know, putting him in an offense gives you a good shot at being top 15, you can get somebody else. You can get somebody else. You can play him there. I thought his off-ball movement last year was actually quite nice, and his jump shot as catch and shoot is solid. So that doesn't make him a better prospect than Smith in any way, but it is another piece of his value. So even if he doesn't reach a ceiling, he's helping your team more than just like a low-end point guard, like let's say Dennis Schroeder. Like Dennis Schroeder has that element of him where it's like whether he ends up reaching the top or the bottom, he's still a point guard and that's it.
Well, you're talking about helping the team. If you love fantasy basketball, you can use draft and draft guys to help your team. You're not using salary cap league to create a lineup. You're not using pre-planned salaries. You're doing a snake draft instead. It takes you 2 to 3 minutes. But the beauty of it is that you're not going up against pros nearly as much, because in salary cap situations, pros can enter 100 lineups a day if they want to, or even more, and put the odds in their favor if you're just trying to enter a few games a day and have a good time. With drafts, too time consuming for the pros, so you're not going up against nearly as many of those, and that increases your chances of actually winning, which of course is why this is fun. You can play for cold hard cash, but drafts start from just $1, so there's a draft for everyone. You can join one every couple of minutes as well. Again, they really help out the fantasy player who's new, is just trying to have a good time. They take care of last minute injuries for you, and once you're done drafting for the night, you settle in, you watch your guys, that's it. No trades, no waiver wire. You don't have to deal with management in fantasy football right now. My team is out of it, and I like keep forgetting to set my lineup. It's like, you know, daily fantasy, you don't have to bother with that stuff. So the way to get started with them, you can download the app anytime. Just search Draft in the App Store and or on Google Play. Join a game in minutes. You can play from your computer on draft.com as well. And all new players can get a free entry into a draft when you make your first deposit using my promo code CAPSPACE. That'll let them know, of course, that you came from us. Easy to remember, CAPSPACE. We talked about it all the time on the program. So you can play a real money game for free. Just use the promo code CAPSPACE on your first deposit. All right, where should we go next here?
Question from Matt Needham. If you, basically, who is the worst best player on a team?
So let's assemble our list of candidates as we so often do. Team Bulls, Team Kings, that's probably it. Team Lakers, maybe, because remember
what
we
about,
struggled
what about
to figure
Team
out
Nets? Who. Is Carroll better than these guys?
What about D'Angelo Russell? You're saying that he's just so bad defensively that...
Well, no, I mean, D'Angelo Russell, to me, it's more about potential than production right now. Like, would you say that he has provided the most value even per minute on the Nets so far this year?
Well, if you're, he's not even in the same league as the Bulls. The Bulls have
that I will agree with.
Yeah, or the Kings. I mean, you know, so you could put maybe like the Hawks with Dennis Schroeder and
yeah, that's KCP. Kind of where I was thinking. Like,
but KCP was a guy who, I mean, if you think about it, just like, hey, everyone in the league was a free agent this year, and who would get like a good contract? You know, KCP is kind of would get like starter level of money. There's really Lopez is a center, though his usefulness is kind of limited. He's probably still the best player on the Bulls. Markkanen, you know, has been scoring because they don't have anyone else, but I'm not going to say a rookie with 10 games under his belt is that good. But you know, I think so. It's between the Bulls with Markkanen or Lopez right now, and then who is it on the Kings? I mean, you can't even identify their best player. Zach Randolph, like George Hill, and none of their rookies are that good. De'Aaron Fox is a 450 true shooting percentage right now. You can't really say him. Like, I mean, you can't even identify anyone. I don't think they have like one quality starter on their team right now.
I think I would take all three of the top guys on the Bulls over anyone on the Kings.
I mean, I don't know. Is Lauri Markkanen really a better player than Zach Randolph? Lopez probably is for sure. I mean, Lopez is at least a quality starter.
And Levine is. And Levine is too, when he's healthy.
He's a quality starter. I don't know about that. I mean, he puts up numbers, but
Is Zach Randolph a quality starter?
I mean, he has been at least at one point.
Well,
no, he's not a quality starter. No, you're saying you'd take Levine over anyone on the Kings? things when healthy.
Right.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, I mean, because if we were talking about George Hill in April of last season, like early April, not when he wasn't playing. Yeah, I mean, George Hill would be better than all those guys, but he has been awful this year and awful in a way that I'm not sure is going to be corrected in the near term. So I'm gonna, yeah. It's entirely possible that when he recovers from this toe issue, that he will be a lot better. But we can't treat that as a given, at least not for right now.
No, and certainly not when it's been a chronic thing for him. So yeah, I mean, I think you probably would have to go with the Kings right now. I mean, that's amazing to say a team doesn't have a single quality starter.
Well, and think about how much money they spent. Think about how much money, not only for this year, but for future seasons, they spent this past offseason, and that's still true.
Ooh, baby. Yeah, and before this year, the Magic might have been in this conversation, but even then, you know, Fournier was okay. Aaron Gordon obviously has been excellent this year, so he takes them out of that running. Vooch has been better than anyone on the Kings. I mean, the Magic have, like, and obviously they're playing extremely well right now too. So, and then the Lakers, KCP is clearly better than anyone on the Kings. Brook Lopez is clearly better than anyone on the Kings. So, yeah, I think it's probably the Kings, and that's how you end up losing by 46 points to a 2-11 Hawks team. This a 2-11 Hawks team that set the franchise record for largest victory in their history tonight.
We're about 2 weeks away from doing our first award show, because we decided, we had a powwow and we decided to do it at the end of November. Can we just basically decide by acclamation that Kings game is going to be the worst loss so far? I mean, it's hard to conceive of something worse.
Yeah, that is.
I mean, you get housed by 46 against a team that, like, I mean,
well, and then maybe the worst loss would be the Thunder losing at the Kings last week.
I was thinking of it as worst loss, not best win, because I feel like the best win can't be against the team as atrocious as these Kings are. But either way, well, it'll be a fun discussion.
Oh yeah, I guess they're both candidates for worst loss, and maybe we can award it to them both. I always enjoy that category. All right, Idan Livne. Sorry, Idan, I don't have a high degree of confidence on that one, but we did tell you guys if you want to have your name pronounced correctly, include a phonetic pronunciation. Ken Spencer Dinwiddie become the Nets' Robert Covington, a fringe guy picked up in the middle of a long rebuild to become a key rotation piece. And they did both on similar kind of long, non-guaranteed contracts. So there are two components to this. Mm-hmm. No, please. After you made that noise, you should be allowed to talk now.
Yeah, well, so the word rotation is doing some pretty heavy lifting here, because what Robert Covington is a starter on what could be a very good team. And I don't see Dinwiddie becoming that guy. You know, I think Dinwiddie, if you're answering their question of a fringe guy who can become a rotation piece, yes, absolutely, he can be that. But a key rotation piece seems a little bit strong. Like, do you see a reasonable path for Dinwiddie to become, let's say, one of the 35 or 40 best point guards in the NBA?
Yeah, maybe. But there's a few things we got to talk about here. Number one, Covington is probably a top 15 player at his position. He just got that renegotiation and extension day, which we'll probably do news tomorrow, so we'll get to that then. Yeah, Covington is probably a top 15 small forward, and that's also the league's rarest position as well. And then Dinwiddie, I know we've been talking a lot about how good he has looked this year, but it's worth noting that he's shooting 34% on twos this year. You know, and he has been hitting the three ball. He had a solid run last year of competent backup point guard play with the Nets. And this year, we'll see. He's going to have a little bit more time here before Russell returns, and they're going to start playing those two guys together more, I would imagine. But, I mean, really, I could see it possible that maybe Dinwiddie becomes like a very lower end starter. So the level that you're talking about, yeah, I could see that's possible. I mean, he's shown some burst, he's shown some shooting ability, he's got size. It's not impossible to me. No. But he also, I mean, we got to slow down a little bit too. And also, he's going to turn 25 very shortly here too. So he's getting close, likely, to what his ceiling is. Although obviously he's had those improvements after the ACL tear suffered in college. But no, I don't think that the two are particularly comparable. But you know, Covington came out of nowhere, and there are players who come out of nowhere, but especially when you consider that point guard, there's so much more competition to be a top 15 point guard than there is at small forward. But that means also that great small forwards who can shoot and defend are rarer. I mean, he's not a great small forward. He's a good small forward. No. So I think it's very unlikely. I mean, that's what makes Covington so remarkable. Although Schmitz was at the Lakers game today and he was tweeting like, hey, you know what? This guy has this huge wingspan and he shot 42% on threes in his last college season. Like, no way he goes undrafted these days.
Yeah, I don't remember because he was it was such a small school that I don't really remember even being familiar with him at that point. But it's right. I mean, especially now with the money that teams are throwing into analytic departments and things like that, it feels like somebody would have seen like that those attributes and at least gotten him in for a workout, and then probably somebody would have fallen in love with him. I think that's fair.
Aaron Chan, do you guys typically watch games with announcers? If so, who are your favorite and least favorite to listen to? I will say that I generally, you know, I have my favorites for sure, but I'll try to listen to the home feed, even ones that I don't like, just so I make sure I'm like getting both perspectives often enough throughout the year. It could be very difficult to, I would say, and he says, oh, you can admit that your least favorite if it'll get you in trouble. No, it's fine. I could be honest about that. I think local TV crews is like the last bastion of people who just like don't listen to Dunked On at all. But, So, although maybe we can flatter ourselves and hope that Jim Peterson watches since he's actually been on the show. And so is Lamar Hurd, but we really like them.
Well, so, and so is Kara Lawson.
No, yeah, we could.
And
right.
And yeah, Kara's doing a fabulous job with the Wizards.
Yeah. I guess maybe we can edit it to say that announcers we don't like is probably the last bastion of people that just a category we could say doesn't listen to Dunked On. Because,
well, no, that,
know,
that
if
end,
they did
that
listen
end,
to Dunked On, no, we wouldn't not like them, right? Like they would have the type of mentality where like they'd be a little more open-minded. They wouldn't just repeat all these boring tropes, you know.
I am blatantly offended that you have ignored the true last bastion of people who will listen to Dunked On, and that is the broadcasters of the Players Only broadcast other than Brent Berry.
No, I don't know actually. Greg Anthony and Steve Smith both follow me on Twitter.
Okay.
I actually like those guys too. I mean, when they had Chuck on, it was intolerable yesterday because then what was killing me about it, and obviously, you know, there are competition in some ways with the Dura NBA show, but like just talk about the game, Jesus, that's the part.
Like I would love, there are a lot of things that they could do to emphasize the player component of it. Even, you know, like when they've had Dennis Smith as kind of the sideline reporter, I think that's been good, but I think they just it has given me a greater appreciation for having a play-by-play person, and beyond appreciating it even more with what we do with the Twitter NBA show. Like, that's just hard. Like, I get in moments with them where I just, like, if I'm listening to them, I get more lost than if I'm watching. But so to answer the original, I'll answer the first part of the question first, then we can get into best and worst. If I'm watching a game closely, I prefer not to have announcers on, because unless I flip it on, you know, to get a sense of where the crowd is and kind of get a temperature reading, especially if it's going into a stoppage. But I find that it forces me to pay much closer attention, because you have no fallbacks. You know, you have to be watching, otherwise you're missing stuff. But I have, you know, there are plenty of times when it's either I'm working on something or I'm thinking or whatever, that, you know, announcers can be a very important part of it. And so in those points I do it. And so, and of course that ratio like shifts also based on the quality of it. You know, if there's no one good doing the game and I don't have as many options as you, this could also function as a pitch for DirecTV, because your options in terms of announce crews are much better than mine with Comcast. But I think that for me, it does provide that impetus or that onus to actually watch intently.
Okay, now that you're done screwing around, I'll tell everyone who I hate. Cavs.
Yep.
Very little to add, and you know, their color guy, whose name escapes me at the moment, is just like a lot of cliches, just like gets like really passionate, total homers. San Antonio is probably the worst in terms of just being total homers. Can't stand like Bill Land and Sean Elliott, just complete lack of objectivity. It's pretty remarkable there. I would say that those are the two. Denver. Those are probably the three lowest for me. Denver, because Scott Hastings is just like such a curmudgeon. And it's when the other team is doing something awesome, he just like he can't stop complaining about the refs or like some other minutia or like how Denver is getting screwed. You know, like that game where like Russell Westbrook went crazy and like hit that ridiculous three to knock Denver out of the playoffs, and he also the game where he set the triple double record. Like Hastings was just like in his own world. world, like on some like completely like minute nugget stuff, and like couldn't even like enjoy like how ridiculous that performance was, or even if you're not enjoying it, at least like communicate it in just like, oh man, like I can't believe we can't stop this guy, like that kind of thing. Like you're just not giving any kind of credit. And then I would say after that, the Bulls probably would be, but they're not as bad as those three, but still pretty far down there.
I think we should give an honorable mention to the Hawks, at least to Neek. I just, there are moments in time where I just get like, I'm just trying to figure out where he's going with stuff.
I at least like him as a guy though.
No, that's true. And I met him before I started writing and he was delightful. But I find ones that color people that I always have trouble with is where I don't feel I'm learning anything or at least getting any insight if I was a more casual fan. And I have that problem with Neek.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of color guys at this point, and we have to remember too that their job is not necessarily, their job is kind of to entertain and also to like provide some stuff for the casual fan, and Neek will give you some nuggets every once in a while, but also like Bob Rathbun is a pro, he's good enough. I really like him. Or at least a Twitter follower of ours.
Let's do a couple of the best just to have it out.
Oh yeah, of course. Knicks, I think, is number one to me.
Yeah,
like Clyde is just, I mean, he'll get into the old cliches and be curmudgeonly every once in a while, but man, like I really enjoy him. Like his vocabulary is awesome. He's funny. He has like these great insights. The other day, actually, this is pretty good. He said Mike Breen was like, said like something. Oh, you know, that's like an obvious concept or something, and Clyde, this is actually like quite sage. He's like, yeah, everything is obvious once you know it already. And it's like, yeah, that's true, right? Like you have to learn something for the first time at some point in your life. So he's a great, and like Nets, and oh, actually I'll tell you else who I hate is the Lakers. Actually, they're
McDonald. To the Lakers because I watched so much of them when I lived in LA that I am completely impervious to it. It doesn't even it's like water on a duck's back for me now, but I can understand.
They get excited over like totally mundane stuff, and like they like there's for like a marquee franchise that. When you contrast the Nets and the Knicks to them, it's just like they're completely second rate. You'd think that like a franchise that has that many fans would be like, okay, you know, we need to go. And that is frankly, the broadcast is paying that much for the rights as well. You know, that you could get like a really awesome pro who just, and like, they're just not like you don't get a ton of insight from them. They just like get excited over meaningless stuff, especially with this Lakers team being bad. It's just like, and especially in like the last days of Kobe, when like they had to still pretend that Kobe was all good. It was miserable.
So the other ones in contention, so I would say the Knicks are number one. I would say for two, to me, it's a battle between the Nets and the Wolves. I love Peterson and Benz. I think they do a wonderful job. I'm trying to think if there's anybody else who's in that conversation.
I really enjoy the Celtics. Like, I actually find like Scalabrine will at least try to take you to with some next level analysis. You know, I don't appreciate his whole like white Mamba shtick, but he's like a solid analyst, a smart guy. And then Tommy, he's like such a curmudgeon, but he, in some ways, I think he's like almost in on the joke. And he also is like, he gets like so angry that like you understand what he's doing. Like he's completely lost the veneer of objectivity. And I really like Gorman as well. Like he's got a great voice.
To me, the Tommy parallel is sort of to All in the Family, where some people were kind of in on the joke and some people weren't. And I feel like Tommy kind of vacillates between them sometimes, but I enjoy it for what it is. Like, I don't listen to the Celtics broadcast all the time, but it is also absolutely fabulous for teams that, for various reasons, the Celtics and their fans don't like. Those games, especially if they're winning those games, are just glorious on the Celtics feed.
Joel Myers is an absolute pro. The fact that he's not with the Lakers anymore is a total shame. And then Blazers, Calabro and Lamar Hurd is a rising star to me. And then Kings, Napier and Reynolds, especially Napier, like I really appreciate their approach to covering a bad team, the way they dealt with the Cousins era. They're able to be fair and objective and express frustration, but also like still fulfill the function of a local announcer to present the broadcast cast from the local team's perspective and to be enthusiastic when they do stuff well. So I think they do a good job of really skirting that line. So I appreciate that. And especially with the way that they had to deal with Cousins, I appreciated the way that they covered him quite a bit.
Yeah, that's another good one. One I have to mention, just because I've never said this, and since we're being more candid on it, for whatever reason, Ralph Lawler's inflection drives me crazy. The rest of it, I'm not too much, but for whatever reason, like the way he accentuates things, it just bothers me for some reason. I don't know exactly what it is. I don't know if there's some sort of deep psychological thing there, but it drives me a little crazy.
Everyone hated on Michael Smith. I never thought he was that bad. I thought he made a good effort to understand advanced statistics and use them, and you know, he never really said that much stuff that I hated. And then, you know, he got canned this year for Bruce Bowen, who I thought has been pretty miserable so far. He was actually the reason. In fact, actually, Bruce Bowen might deserve a little bit of credit for the fact that Dunked On exists, because he took over NBA Lockdown from Ryan Russillo. And, you know, that was like kind of like my NBA go-to podcast when he was doing like Tales from the Couch many years ago. You know, even like, you know, 2010, 2011. I mean, I remember him getting in all kinds of shit because he's like told Mavericks fans like, no way, you're never gonna beat the Lakers, like the year that they won the championship. But you know, Russell, I always enjoyed his stuff. And then Bowen came on and I was like, man, this is terrible. And so I was like, all right, you know, someone needs to like fill the void here. I mean, it was years later, but it kind of definitely pushed me in the direction of like, oh hey, you know, maybe I should start a podcast, you know, once I started writing.
Oh, what a fun time.
Yeah, I mean, we really got going on that. That was like 15 minutes on like just total league pass minutia.
You know what? I bet people are really going to enjoy that.
We'll see. Should we Nathan do another another question about like actual basketball instead of just like verbal masturbation of our own opinions about other media personnel, which is like maybe going a little far, but you know, we got asked, so.
We got asked. Nathan, I thought that was going to be on the Patreon mailbag, but anyway, Nathan Holmes.
No. We can't do this one. Let's do a real basketball question. We'll save this one for later. We already did it. We can't do another meta question right now. How about this one? What should or can the Knicks do to get out of the Noah contract? He will be due about $18 million per season this year, and then the 2 years after this one.
They shouldn't do anything right away. The reason that you would unload that contract is parallel what the Lakers might have to do with Luol Deng, and it's because you need that space to get somebody who's way better. They could theoretically stretch him if they absolutely had to, but I think the Knicks just grin and bear it for now, unless some other team makes a heinous mistake, which I sincerely doubt they will. And then if you reach a point where you're having these conversations, because the Knicks can still get in the room with a lot of people, and you realize that the only way that you can do something is to unload that contract, then at that point you figure it out, whether it's through the stretch revision or through trading it with assets attached or something like that.
Yeah, well, they actually could in theory do the same thing with Noah that Pinkus is talking about the Lakers doing with Luol Deng, which actually we can get to after the break. But I totally agree with you, Danny, that there's no reason to do anything right now. And now if they're just not at the point as a team, the Lakers, you know, if they have a belief that they can get two superstars, yeah, okay, they clear the space. But where the Knicks are as a team, I mean, the whole reason that they got in trouble signing Noah at the first place was, oh, we have to get better right away, we have to build around Carmelo. We'll see where they end up this year. I mean, if they could make the playoffs somehow, which they are in position to do, and their fundamentals aren't as bad as they have been in past years when they've been kind of playing above expectations, but we'll see if this can keep up for them. I still suspect that it will not. Porzingis in particular has been a little bit over his head in terms of unsustainable shooting, and they're extremely reliant on him offensively. But you know, if they win 35 games this year and show some progress, yeah, you chill out. I mean, if you actually think, hey, we could get like a star level of player, and the only way to do that is to clear out Noah, all right, then you move heaven and earth to do it. But otherwise, I think you might as well just keep him around. And we'll take that question on Pincus's idea, which I thought was a very interesting one, right after this from stamps.com. Danny, you've been using stamps.com quite a bit of late.
I have been. You have to send a lot of packages when you get a book, and I'm gonna hopefully be doing more of those when I start putting out the call for signed copies. And dealing with the post office is a challenge when you're dealing in volume. And stamps.com, I'd been familiar with the concept, of course, but I hadn't used it before, and it has been such a wonderful time saver in terms of being able to print postage yourself. They gave me a scale, which is fantastic, and being able to arrange pickups. It makes something that used to be such a pain completely tolerable, manageable, and never quite enjoyable, but to take what was such a big burden and make it fine is a godsend.
Yeah, with the holidays coming up, it's a great time for you to get started with stamps.com as well. It'll help you save time if you're sending holiday cards and gifts. Buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter, any package, any class of mail using your own computer and printer, and then the mailman comes and picks it up. That makes things really easy if you're returning packages. We've got this new house. We've been ordering stuff and returning it very easily with them. They'll send you a digital scale that automatically calculates your exact postage. It'll help you decide the best class of mail every time. I like it too because I do a lot of work late at night. Stamps.com is always open, unlike the post office. Right now, you too can enjoy their service with a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus postage and that digital scale without long-term commitments. Go to stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in that familiar code, CAPSPACE. Easy to remember because we talk about it all the time in the program. That's CAPSPACE, all one word. Stamps.com, enter code CAPSPACE. Let them know that you came from us. So yeah, we got a question on this, which was an interesting one. And Eric Pincus's idea was essentially that the Lakers, as a way to get rid of Luol Deng without having to give up any assets, would utilize an interesting provision of the stretch provision, which is basically when you stretch a player, you can elect to spread his remaining guaranteed salary over twice the number of years remaining on the contract plus one. There's a little loophole, which if this gets done, I'm sure will instantly be filled in the next CBA, and probably should have been in this one actually, that even if you have non-guaranteed money, you can stretch over the non-guaranteed years. So in the case of Luol Deng, he has about $36 million left. What Pincus suggested was they actually give him an extension for an additional 3 years, bringing it now to a 5-year contract and making it for the same amount of money, but pretty much all non-guaranteed. Maybe they'd give him an extra $3 million or so guaranteed, enough that like one could credibly believe that they were making it worth his while. And then when you stretch him, it would be a 5-year deal in total, stretched out over double the number of years remaining on the contract. That makes it 10 plus 1, which is 11. So now you're basically taking $39 million and you're stretching it over 11 years. I mean, that's a long time to have 4% of the salary cap used up, but now you're creating the space and you didn't have to give up any draft picks or assets to do so.
So first things first, it is a very creative and ingenious idea. And if the NBA allowed it, I mean, I think that's the real challenge here. And yep. In the piece, he talks with, you know, there's a conversation with Larry Kuhn, and where I think the real challenge with this is in terms of circumvention, and circumvention is this area. I mean, even those of us who live this world have blatant uncertainty, but one of the basic rules is that if every single other GM and owner is going absolutely insane, that puts some pressure on Silver and everybody else. And really, because the intent here is absolutely to circumvent. Like, that is straight up, that's what the intent is. The intent is to circumvent the rules for stretching a contract. That is what they are trying to do. So that is where I'm a little bit, but again, that's where you can use the partial guarantees to really make that work. My instinct is that in order to have it not be an all-out riot, it would have to be significant, probably more significant than $3 million. But again, we're in uncharted waters here. So I'm not confident in that. That's just my instinct, because when you look at intent, basically what they're trying to do is they're just trying to get around the rule on how many years you can stretch a contract.
Yeah. Although, I mean, getting around it, they're not doing anything. I mean, I don't think that the extension itself is illegal. You know, they're giving him some more guaranteed money. It's really, they are adhering to the letter of the law. So, circumvention, I'm not sure that that's the right way to put it, but there is really kind of a catch-all under the circumvention provision where, you know, if the league believes that you're doing something that's just like completely unfair that they didn't think of, they essentially can say no. And then, you know, maybe there would be a process that they would have to go through after that to try to fight it because it's not technically against the rules. But I don't know.
Well, that gets insane. Yeah. In this circumstance, because of the specific timeline, because Luol Deng wouldn't be eligible for an extension until July 7th. So if it is not pre-clear, this all might be going on because obviously you're not going to do that unless you have a thing lined up. So if it all hinges on like that $4 million or whatever, I can't remember what the stretch, I think it's about $4 million that the difference is. And it comes down to a league adjudication, it's going to be absolutely bonkers. And I don't know if they would have the gumption to pre-clear it or do something of that nature, but if they did, this is a specific specific enough circumstance that I think it would be a good idea.
Yeah, I mean, you might as well try it, I guess. Yeah. I mean, and then you could always just make a trade to get off of the money then. Well,
it gets into basically, I had been going for the idea of that they could trade Deng for a lower contract, like Miles Plumlee is the guy who I'm circling on this, who makes less money but is worse. And so then they can stretch a smaller amount of money, which is a different way of handling that same problem.
Yeah. But they still would have to give up the assets to get that guy too. But
The Hawks might be willing to pay $5 million more for Deng
they don't want anything to do with Deng.
Maybe they feel that Hawks University or something. Sure. There are other options there too.
I don't know. I think
Hawks University has older entrants. I don't know.
It's about 50-50 whether I think this would work or not. All right, let's get back to this kind of funny question from Nathan Holmes. Basically, he asked, like, from just like all the basketball that we watch and like doing Dunk Tom, do you think we would have improved our hypothetical skills coaching a middling youth basketball team? And then he asked for a prediction of, if we were both coaching youth basketball, whose team would win given equal talent between the teams?
Well, I'll answer the second part first, and it's you, because you played more basketball growing up and had more training. I didn't. I wasn't tall like you, and I also was into other sports. I played tennis and soccer and other things growing up. And so yeah, you would definitely, because you have the exposure.
I'm also much better at like arrogantly ordering people around.
Also true, but in terms of
which is a prerequisite for a coach of young kids.
But in terms of what we've learned, I mean, it'd be interesting. Pincus would actually be a good person to talk with about that, because I believe he coaches his daughter's team. But the idea of like kind of what approaches have been easier to pick up. So like, I mean, we've seen switch heavy systems do a really nice job in the professional levels, because it's a more basic thing. You know, like if an action comes, you go to your other person, so somebody's on somebody all the time. I think that could, you know, in certain circumstances for the youth teams that actually run stuff, that could be a way to combat it.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on the talent level of the teams too. I mean, and this is something that you hear every once in a while, like I can't remember who it was, but it was someone's like, oh yeah, like, you know, it's sad that like I can watch a month's worth of NBA games and like I don't even come up with any ideas for my high schoolers. Like it's not, you know, like implying that like it's not that complex. It's like, well, you know, that's because NBA plays are for like people who can come off of a screen and shoot a 25-foot three-pointer, right? Like they are to get the NBA's talent is what rules, right? And it's utilizing that talent, it's knowing how to combat that talent, it's extremely detailed scouting reports on what people like to do. Like that's where the bandwidth goes. It's not like, oh yeah, like I just came up with this like completely ridiculous like sideline out of bounds play, because especially like, yeah, you can come up with that and then people see it a couple of times and now it's scouted, you know. So you need stuff that's more, that has optionality to it, that gets your players, your best players, into positions to succeed, as opposed to like, oh yeah, look at this like little Easter egg play that's gonna fool everyone because, you know, you're not scouting the other team six ways from Sunday. So it's a completely different game in the NBA, and I don't think that much, other than if you have people who can shoot, you know, the concepts of just like spacing the floor and helping and stuff. You know, there's also no defensive 3 seconds rule. I coached a little bit just in like, you know, camps and stuff. Dave DeFore actually would be an interesting guy to ask this about, because he actually, you know, did coach in high school, and to see whether he, like his NBA watching, whether he was able to take a lot of stuff from that or not. But there's so much stuff that works at the youth level where it's just like, hey, give the ball to your best player, because there's so much of a difference between the best players and the worst players, and or like play zone or press or all this stuff. Like they're really, I don't think there's that much that you can take from the NBA to just coaching youth basketball. They're really apples and oranges.
I think that's a good lead into Brian Klinger's question, which was, many people are saying Jason Kidd needs to be replaced for the Bucks to become title contenders. Does Kidd deserve more time to prove he's the right coach, and what would you consider realistic benchmarks for him to retain his position? For me, the deserve part of it isn't really relevant. I don't think you see it that way. He's also been there a while, and Kidd is now, he's coached in the league. I think this is his sixth year, something like that.
And his first season was 13-14 in Brooklyn.
So it's fifth season.
Is it fifth season?
Yeah, that's five. But so
yeah,
for me,
right.
the bigger question, it's a process thing, not a results thing. So I don't want to see it in terms of benchmarks. Is he willing to adjust his approach, particularly defensively, to different personnel? I mean, we talked when the Eric Bledsoe trade happened about how they had really good personnel now for switching, and they have their defense. It worked well when he started out there, had some moments in Brooklyn too. But it's not the best approach for his current personnel. And I think the same thing generally offensively. He deserves a lot of credit for developing Embiid. Chris Herrig and I actually talked about this on Real Jam Radio too. But
Giannis, you mean?
Yeah. I have Embiid on the mind for an obvious reason. And so I think that we can have a pretty good sense of that. But then the other part of this is opportunity. You can't really, to me, move on from him unless you have somebody that you believe is the right answer. I don't think this is like Mark Jackson, where you fired him and then Kerr ended up happening. I think that it's a little bit harder maybe in some ways to make this work.
Well, I think Joe Prunty showed at least something when Kidd was out with that hip surgery a couple of years ago. And to me, I agree with you, maybe a mid-season firing, especially since they just got Bledsoe, is not fair. They did exceed expectations last year, but with this team's personnel, if they're not in the top half of the league in defense, or at least, and I'm sure they have internal metrics to look at this, because you know you're going to be unlucky in terms of like opponents hitting shots, or maybe you're lucky. Certainly their 2014-15 team that was number two in the league in defense was a very lucky team. Like, they had opponents shoot really poorly on open three-pointers that year, for example, and we saw them regress a ton, both with the league catching up to them and also with just, you know, the regression to a normal amount of made outside shots. So, I mean, basically that's the idea, is that if this team isn't defending on a solid level, then I think, you know, it's probably time to move on. He's had enough time to prove it. They've had this personnel, and clock is ticking with Giannis. They have the clock is ticking with Bledsoe. Like, this is a team now that arguably has, you know, the third best amount of talent now in the Eastern Conference with the way Giannis is playing. And
I think that's certainly fair.
I mean, they definitely have a big hole at center right now. So that's, you know, big holes can kill you at times. But I mean, maybe you could say the Celtics have more talent if Hayward's healthy, but probably not, actually, in their current iteration.
I'm happy that this opportunity opened up, but you were talking about, you know, looking at the defense and things like that, and trying to separate out the luck part of it. And I am pretty confident that there are people in the Bucks analytics department that are aware and embrace the fact that the NBA is a make or miss league.
Concur. All right, let's do some lightning here. Glenn Simonson, I think I recognize you from Periscope. Dogman 2828 here, though. Is it better for LeBron, if he wants to win future rings, to stay in Cleveland with a future top pick plus what they have? I would assume they're going to re-sign Isaiah. Going to the Lakers with Paul George, or going to San Antonio and teaming up with Kawhi? The latter would assume that they probably had to find a way to just move on from LaMarcus Aldridge to open up some space.
They have to move a lot of space. I actually helped Ben Golver a little bit with his SI piece, because he's like, how could that happen? And it's tough because they have to move just so much salary. But I think, to me, it's the Lakers, but not necessarily because of Paul George itself, but because I think they would be able to attract very high level talent with their remaining exceptions and minimum contracts. So it's not fair to think of it as Lonzo, LeBron, Paul George, Ingram, and probably Brook Lopez at center. I think they would be getting, for 1 year or for 2 years, they would be getting basically fringe starter, or maybe a little worse than that, like talented six men for the minimum, just for an opportunity to play with that team.
Yeah. Or the room exception, and then the mid-level the next right. year. I mean, I think San Antonio is obvious, just because LeBron and Kawhi together, and then Pop coaching them. I mean, that would just be a monster team. They might not get as many veteran ring chasers as you could get in San Antonio, but whoever they got, Pop could really coach them up, and they would finally have some athleticism there. So I think just LeBron being coached by Pop, he'll never do that, though. I think he just wants to have more control over what's going on. He's not going to have that in, you know, a very stolid organization like San Antonio, although, you know, that's not a criticism, because they of course have been awesome. Staying in Cleveland, the future top pick really only comes into play for me during LeBron's prime if they trade him. You know, he's really got, you know, maybe 2-3 years left at the most after this one. I mean, he's still not showing signs of slowing down yet. But, you know, so they would have to, if he says, all right, I'm going to re-up around draft time, trade that pick, get me someone good. Okay. So I would say, and they don't really have a ton left. Love is kind of going downhill. So I would rank it probably. But then, of course, Cleveland is in the East and San Antonio and the Lakers are in the West. And LeBron will probably be over the hill, at least to some degree, before this Golden State juggernaut has ended. So they got to deal with that. But if you're talking about just winning a ring anyway, they have to beat Golden State no matter where they are, as opposed to just getting to the finals. So I'd probably rank it San Antonio, Lakers, Cleveland.
Yeah, that's totally fair. I was thinking about that the Spurs would give up a lot more guys than that, but using your part as a foundation will do that. Question from Mike Shotton. Try to pick a couple players to really follow each year. Last year, loved Isaac. Who are some prospects I could try to follow who might not be a top four pick? So I'm not going to talk about the top of the draft, but who could be interesting NBA players. So I'm excluding the very top of this draft. I'm going to do not the top seven, which is outside of there, but a couple of guys that I just really like that are a little bit later. Nikhil Alexander Walker, I think, is the first player that I can remember that you, me, Schmitz, and Sam Vecenie are all high on and is not a lottery pick. We all like him for different reasons. We've seen him at various things, so I want to mention him. Jared Vanderbilt, I liked a lot at the Hoop Summit last year. He's at Kentucky this year. He's worth watching. Kentucky's worth watching as well because of Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, who's fun to watch this year. And those are probably the three that I would focus on. But really, I would keep an eye on, you know, like Mo Bamba at Texas. Like that, he'll be a lot of fun too. And you
yeah,
know,
I mean, he's probably a top five guy. So I mean, I guess I didn't really particularly. no, my that ship has sailed. I'm afraid. Yeah, I know. We can still look back at the days when I was getting angry at Coach Roy Rena. I've since apologized to him for playing Jamal Murray over Svi, thinking like, how could they? And at the time, I was like, oh man, this guy is like dominant. Like, how are you not playing a blah, blah? And like, nah, actually, Jamal Murray turned out a little better than him. Roy probably had that one right. I was like, oh, he's a Canadian coach. Like, of course he's going to like, you know, play Jamal Murray. Like, no, calm down. Roy had that one right, Nate. And then, I mean, maybe I didn't really care for his level of basketball IQ and his shot selection, but Kevin Knox on Kentucky is certainly someone who, especially if he starts hitting shots, who has the athleticism to really be kind of a modern four type of player. But, you know, I mean, it always takes us a while to lock in on this. So we're usually not the like, oh, hey, do you like these sleepers in the draft? Like we'll do the top 10. We'll do it after the season if you're a new listener. But and I'll probably hope to have Mike Schmitz on soon to talk about this draft. But we're not the guys to ask on that. I don't think.
Just watch Kentucky.
All right. I'll just do this one quickly. Frank Urbina asks, will anyone be bold enough to hand Aaron Gordon a max offer sheet this summer? And who might that be? So here are some of the teams that have space and I think could really use him. I mean, and we'll assume that he won't keep shooting this crazy percentage on threes, but that he'll shoot a solid percentage. And, you know, even if he ends up shooting like high 30s at the end of the year, you know, talking about a max offer sheet for him is not insane, especially when you've got young teams. He is very young. He was one of the youngest guys in his draft. And if he's hitting shots like this, then you throw in his defensive potential, his ability to attack the rim, get on the glass, get out in transition. You know, he's not going to be your number one option with the ball in his hands necessarily, but as a guy who can attack off a closeout, maybe be a third scorer, and give you that amount of athleticism and switchability defensively, I think, you know, I mean, he's certainly more deserving of a max contract if he shoots like this all year than Otto Porter. So, I mean, sadly enough, the Kings won't have any space to give out a max offer sheet this year because, you know, unless they trade away George Hill or Zach Randolph, which they won't be able to do with those salaries. So certainly Atlanta falls into that category. Brooklyn probably won't have the space. Atlanta may not either. They're dependent on those player options with Dedmon and Muscala. The Bulls, Markkanen and Gordon would be a very interesting, not a great fit together necessarily. Indiana is going to have a ton of space if Thaddeus Young opts out. The Lakers, he could be a backup option there if they don't get their big stars. What about Philly? Philly would be an interesting one.
If his shooting is for real, it would be possible. And also he has a lower max, so that helps.
Yeah, so a lot of that depends on what happens with Fultz too, and he still is not a great shooter, but just having that level of athleticism and switchability, I mean, you think of that, the defense with Simmons, him, and Bede, Covington, I mean, that would just be an absolute monster defensive group. yeah, that's probably about it in terms of teams that can get anywhere close to max space. Dallas could be a potential option as well. I think like he and Barnes could fit together reasonably. You know, it depends.
That'd be fun.
Again, what happens with Dirk's team option? What happens with Noel? You know, they're looking like Noel is not even going to be on their books anymore at this rate. But so they could get right around there too.
Yeah, and I could see them being a player for Cousins and a few other guys. So it's just going to be about what they prioritize. Because the problem with Aaron Gordon is there's a chance that the Magic just match that. So they would start to get close to luxury tax land. But so I there are only two more questions that I want to do, and I think we can do them both pretty quickly. From Matt, I cannot pronounce your last name, Publica. After the Bledsoe trade, both you guys were both pessimistic the Suns would use Monroe's expiring to take on more assets. Why is that? Phoenix history, reporting, sourcing, other. And it's two different elements for me. One is Monroe is talented, but I don't think there's a ton of like value for him at his price in terms of him, that player, that contract as a value. And so that limits the return you can get. And then the second part is it doesn't appear that the Suns want to take on long-term money, because if they wanted to take on long-term money, they could have done it from the Bucks. The Bucks had plenty of guys at basically any salary band to make that work. They chose not to do it. And my assumption, whether that's fair or foul, is that the Bucks would have given more assets in return. And so the fact that they chose that and that it fits Sarver's MO ties it in for me.
Yeah, and it's just, it's been said that they don't want to, they're actually trying to get off of money in theory. So yeah, I think that's the issue there. What was the last one you wanted to do so we can wrap up here?
From Miguel Verduzco, how much of a problem is it that James Harden often puts zero effort on defense? It seems like he gives up on several plays per game. And the complete give ups are a big problem, because those plays just sabotage your entire defense. If you get a no resistance blow by like that one on Serge Ibaka, there is no way that you can recover unless your guy happens to be in the right place at the right time. And so those are damaging. I mean, it basically turns whatever you have the expected value of a possession, could put it around 1.1 into like 2. And so on that possession, that's pretty catastrophic.
Yeah, it's interesting. If you watch the angle at which NBA players generally will attack a defensive player in an isolation, especially just from a standstill, a lot of it is they almost start horizontally and then like almost turn the corner once they've beaten the guy. Whereas, you know, if you're just in a pickup game, you just kind of, your first step, you just blow by the guy. There's some guys who do that in the NBA, but not that many, or you got to at least fake the guy out first. But if you're just giving up just a straight line drive, you're not even like making the guy make a move before he beats you, and then just gets right to the rim, there just isn't time for the help to get there. And then also plays like that are so obvious on film. You have, and I get it, like Harden is busting his ass on offense. He's a wonderful offensive player, but it's just so hard to build a defensive culture. If you compare Harden to Steph Curry, there is absolutely zero comparison. Even if, you know, at many times, Steph Curry just doesn't have the size and he just can't stop guys. Number one, he's not just giving up a straight blow by. He's at least trying. He's getting into guys. He's moving his feet. He's in a stance. And players can respect, okay, you're trying hard, but you just don't have the physical capabilities. If you're just straight up standing up and down, if you're just not, you're not even getting into a stance, much less even trying to make one slide. I mean, it's not like, okay, I tried to slide with you and then he changed direction and crossed me up. It's just, he went in one direction. I didn't even move to try and get in front of him. And this isn't only that one play against Ibaka yesterday when people were trying to excuse it because he had 5 fouls, which was ridiculous. Because number one, you can still make an effort when you have 5 fouls. And number two, it happens several times a game. It happened several times in that Cleveland game that we did for the Twitter NBA show. So yeah, no, it's a massive problem. It sucks. All right, I think we're done here.
Yeah.
With that declarative statement.
Well, I don't know if I'm ready to promote it yet because I don't know if it's coming out on Thursday, but I do have a piece that is coming out for the Sporting News on a topic that I've been interested in for a while and we haven't talked that much about on the show, of the significance of the NBA moving up the trade deadline. And so what I focused on was the passage of time and how moving it up changes how teams are going to evaluate their own prospects and buyers and sellers and everything like that.
You said that you weren't sure if you were going to promote it, and then you did. So I guess you achieved some clarity.
I did, because I'm not sure when it's coming out, and then I realized, I'm like, well, people can keep an eye out for it.
Yes, and it probably will come out before we get a chance to plug it again. That'll do it for today's program. Check out the Twitter NBA show, that Golden State-Boston game. We're going to do that one, and then maybe we'll do Houston-Phoenix as well, especially if Chris Paul is back. We'll kind of see how we're feeling after that first game, whether we want to continue it as well. But you can follow me on Periscope at Nate Duncan NBA. I'll be tweeting it out at Nate Duncan NBA as well. And thanks again to Draft for sponsoring today's show. It's not too late to join what is the highest rated fantasy football app for fantasy basketball. That is Draft. Download the app anytime. Just search Draft in your app store, join a game in minutes, or play right from your computer on draft.com, whichever you prefer. For a limited time only, all new players get a free entry into a draft when you make your first deposit. But of course, you have to use that familiar promo code CAPSPACE. Easy to remember because we talk about it all the time on the program. You can play a real money game for free. Use that promo code CAPSPACE. Let them know that you came from us, and you can play that real money game for free on your first deposit.